From WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. United States General Tommy Franks, the man who ran the war in Iraq, held the fate of nations in his hands and won the war swiftly, makes $153,000 a year. It's a far cry from the tens of millions pocketed every year by many American CEOs. Now a few stratospheric pay packages have begun to come down. But the median is still up. Even after scandal, recession, massive layoffs, and the stock market bust, CEO pay is still levitating. Tonight on Point, the unnamed scandal, CEO pay in America. We begin in New York with John Cassidy, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and author of The Greed Cycle, How the Financial System Encouraged Corporations to Go Crazy. I asked him whether we are still in a greed cycle.
Surprisingly, we are. If you look at the latest figures, it seems that chief executives, although they're not being paid quite as much as they were two or three years ago, are still awarding themselves enormous sums and big stock options, etc. So although the stock market has fallen quite dramatically, you know, the leaders of American industry and finance are still making a lot of money.
How can this be after the tremendous fall in the stock market, after the sluggishness that has led to layoffs all over the place? How can it be that top executives in the United States are still having such great rewards?
Well, I think what has happened is we've had a stock market collapse, but the sort of underlying ideology which justifies these enormous payments to chief executives is still in effect, or still believed, rather, by companies.
And that ideology is?
The ideology is that you have to align the interests of the stockholders with the senior managers. That's a bit of economic jargon. What it basically means is that you have to give the chief executives large chunks of stock so that they try and increase the stock price in the interests of the stockholders. And during the 1990s, that idea was taken to enormous lengths, and chief executives ended up being given hundreds of millions of dollars worth of stock options. Now, as I say, that trend has moderated slightly during the recession we've had in the last couple of years. But most companies still believe in giving their senior managers a lot of stock options and large bonuses if they get the stock price up. And that really hasn't changed. And that's the basis of these enormous contracts that we still see being awarded.
But with the stock market so far down, how can stock options be providing riches for executives?
That's the trickery of the thing. The value of stock options doesn't depend on the stock market. It depends on what price you attach to the stock options. For example, say you're the chairman of America Online. The stock was trading a couple of years ago at $70 or $80. If you got stock at $50, then obviously you made $25 per stock. Now the stock's trading around 10 or 12, so what the company does is instead of issuing stock to its senior managers at $50, it issues them at $10 or $8, so each stock is still worth money. The companies reprice the stock options in order to make them valuable even when the market has fallen. It's a sort of win-win situation for senior managers. If the stock market goes up, then their existing options make a lot of money. If the stock market goes down, they get their options repriced at a lower level, so they still end up making money. It's really a pretty remarkable situation.
John Cassidy, where are the interests of the stockholders and of the country at large in all this? How are they being treated in this system?
Well, that's a very big question. I mean, defenders of this type of arrangement would say that it works well for the country as a whole and works well for stockholders because companies are encouraged to be efficient, they're encouraged to innovate and do whatever they can to get stock prices up. But I think that argument, you know, took some serious knocks in the late 1990s and the last few years, because in a lot of these cases, senior executives were being rewarded not for real achievement, but just for the fact that the stock market in general was going up. It didn't really matter how well your individual company was going. The stock market was rising so quickly that anybody who was in a senior position in corporate America was being rewarded enormously. Thinking of that in terms of the national interest, that can't be in the national interest because it alienates people lower down the corporations who see their bosses getting rich while they're not doing very well. And it doesn't actually reward effort. It just rewards being in a senior position. So it can't really be in the national interest.
You know, these huge pay packages don't happen by miracle or accident. They're designed by people. Why are boards of directors, why are people in positions of power doling out these great big packages, even now when everything's down?
That's the other aspect of the scandal, of course. The thing is that most corporate boards, or not most, but a large number of corporate boards are still dominated by insiders. The chairman tends to appoint the other executives, including the non-executive directors who are supposed to defend the interests of the outside shareholders. So what that means is that the board committees who set senior executives' pay are friends and golfing partners or whatever of the chairman and the senior executive. So, you know, the police force is on the same side as the crooks in this case, in a lot of cases. Crooks may be stretching it slightly, but certainly the police force is on the same side as the chief executives, and they award them big gains. In a lot of cases, it's a sort of you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back situation, because the outside directors are also chief executives of different corporations where the chairman might be the, you know, on the outside board. So they're awarding each other large packages. There have been some reforms introduced by the New York Stock Exchange and other regulatory authorities in the last couple of years to try and make independent board members truly independent, but it's a little early to say what sort of effect those reforms will have.
Is there any way to blow apart this kind of mutual back-scratching relationship, or is this just what the American system of capitalism produces?
Well, that's a good question. There's probably no way to get rid of it completely. There are ways to make it a lot more fair than it is at the moment, and I think the way to do it is to go further in the direction of reforms, in the sense of anybody who's supposed to be an independent director of a company should have nothing to do with that company, really, and should have no financial interest in the chairman doing well. That should be a law, really, rather than just a regulation of the New York Stock Exchange, I think. But Congress, I think, has a lot to answer for here, because after initially expressing some interest in getting tough with corporations, nothing really has happened. There have been a few minor accounting changes, but especially since the war started, the whole subject has been shelved. And as a result of that, once the market turns up again, assuming it does, senior executives will, you know, be earning a fortune yet again.
John, you've written about an orgy of self-enrichment in the executive suites. After everyone you've talked to and all the time you've spent looking at this, if the compensation of American executives was somehow to be miraculously halved or right, cut by even more than half, do you think that American corporations would perform less well?
No, not at all. I mean, there's no evidence whatsoever that corporate performance is enhanced by giving the chief executive $100 million rather than $50 million or rather than $25 million. I think a lot of senior executives would even admit to that. What's happened is that the senior executives and chief executives are in a sort of race with each other. It's not the absolute sums they really care about. It's the fact that their rivals or their friends in other companies, if they're earning $75 million, then I deserve $75 million. Other countries in Europe and Asia pay their senior executives in very profitable companies like Sony and a lot of the British companies and French companies a tenth of what senior executives in corporate America are paid. It's just this culture has grown up in the United States that if you head a big company, you deserve to be paid unlimited amounts. It may be slightly damage a few companies in the long term, although there's not much even much evidence of that. I think it would actually make American capitalism a lot healthier, because the public would support it, and it would be seen to be a lot fairer if the chief executives were paid reasonably.
John Cassidy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
John Cassidy, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He spoke with me earlier from New York. In the two decades after 1980, rank-and-file pay in America rose by 15%, while CEO pay went over the moon, up 600%. Much of that gain came in the form of huge stock option grants that essentially transferred wealth from shareholders to the pockets of America's chief executives. By some calculations, CEO pay declined last year. But take away the outlying extremes of compensation, and median CEO pay is still up again. After scandal and bust and losses and layoffs, American CEO pay is still off the charts. For outraged shareholders, flat pay employees, the millions out of work, and even some leading business thinkers, something looks out of whack with the American way of paying CEOs. Are huge CEO packages good for American capitalism? Are they good for America? Is it possible that a privileged band of overpaid executives have hijacked the American economic system? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from St. Louis is Brian Hall, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School and a widely published author on corporate governance and executive compensation. Good evening and welcome, Brian Hall.
Hi, happy to be here.
Good to have you. Thanks for joining us. And also joining me in the studio tonight is Robert Reich, professor of social and economic policy at Brandeis University and former secretary of labor under President Bill Clinton. Robert Reich, good to have you here. Good to have you back.
Tom, it's good to be here.
It's good to have you. Brian Hall, let me jump in with you first. You've written very recently as this month, about a crisis over executive pay. How would you describe the nature, the dimensions of that crisis?
Well, I guess the way I view it is, you know, the main problem with executive pay is the process that's used to pay them. Listening to the program earlier, people talked about the repricing, you know, that goes on.
That is of options. So you get options at one strike price. That is, and then if the share price falls, you have boards of directors repricing them lower so executives can still cash in even if they didn't push the stock price up.
Right, and actually that doesn't happen. If you actually look at the data, repricing has virtually disappeared since the 1998 accounting rule changes that made it very punitive to do repricing.
So it's not that it hasn't happened, but you're saying it's no longer a major factor.
It really isn't. But what is happening, and the reason that I think executive pay is not down as much as everybody thought this year, is that because we use options to pay people, when options fall underwater, what tends to happen is you get very large option grants the following year in order to make up for the fact that executives no longer have options that are in the money, and they say that the options are underwater, and this, so therefore they're not going to create ownership incentives, and they're not going to create retention incentives. And so I just completed a study, and one of the things that we found was that the biggest option packages went to the big winners, mm-hmm. people who did very well in the previous year, and to the biggest losers. In other words, when stock prices fell a lot.
Which, of course, gets people's gall. I want to ask you, I've taken these statistics from your report about rank-and-file American pay rising 15% in the two decades after 1980 and CEO pay rising 600%. Are those numbers reflective of what these two groups really contributed to the American economy? Did American CEOs contribute 20 times as much as American rank-and-file workers to whatever success this economy has had in the last 20 years?
Well, you know, to be honest, I don't think you can really look at outcomes and
why not
make strong determinants. Because, for example, Tiger Woods – now, I'm going to backtrack and actually say that I think the pay system is broken and CEOs are overpaid. But I don't think you can look at statistics like that and make strong statements. For example, you know, Tiger Woods makes dramatically more than Jack Nicklaus made.
Tiger Woods is an entertainer. Jack Nicklaus is no longer the top of the heap. They're both golfers. But what about two groups of workers? I mean, CEOs are workers, rank-and-file workers.
Well, no, in this case, it's even better. Jack Nicklaus was a golfer at one time, and mm-hmm. Tiger Woods is also a golfer. And during their time, they were both the best golfers, on the planet.
So different times, different compensations.
10 to 20 times more than they made before.
Well, so I want to turn to Robert Reich before we head into the break here, Brian Hall. Please stand by. Robert Reich, how about it? Are CEOs now celebrities on a par with celebrity athletes who should be compensated in that way?
Tom, I don't think so. And you have only to look at the poor performance of many of these companies and ask, why is it that so many CEOs are actually doing better this year than they did last year? For example, David Kaminsky, chairman of Merrill Lynch, got $14.4 million, including a $7 million bonus last year. Now, the stock price of Merrill Lynch dropped dramatically, and they laid off 6,500 employees. In those circumstances, it's hard to understand how these CEOs can, with a straight face, say they're worth it. And I could give you a long list. Look at Leo Mullen, Delta Airlines. His compensation went up to $13.8 million, up 104% last year, even though Delta laid off a huge number of employees. Delta is practically, well, all the airlines are doing terribly, and the shareholder return was down 58% last year. Mm. There's no way of making any sense of this. Mm.
Robert Reich, Brian Hall, please stand by. We really want to dig into CEO compensation. It's what we're looking at. After scandal and recession and stock market crash, it's still Off the charts, it's 2 years since the 90s bubble burst. Why is American CEO compensation still so high? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about CEO compensation in America. After scandal and recession and stock market crash, it's still off the charts. You're welcome to join the conversation. Is hypercompensation necessary for capitalism to work? Are CEOs a separate race of supermen and women that need multi-millions to function? And amid layoffs and trashed retirement packages, are these pay packages obscene or reasonable? What is reasonable for an American CEO? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Brian Hall, professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School, and Robert Reich, professor of social and economic policy at Brandeis University, former secretary of labor under President Bill Clinton, and author most recently of I'll Be Short, Essentials for a Decent Working Society. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. Brian Hall, let me turn once more to you. I'm looking at a quote from Warren Buffett that actually came up in a forum that you recently held at the Harvard Business School, saying, if I had to bet on a great CEO and a bad business, or a mediocre CEO and a great business, I'd take the great business, suggesting that it's the business and the times, not the man or woman who make this happen. I'm also looking here at a quote from Paul Volcker, looking at the stock options that are awarded, and saying that that this is just subject to abuse, and we ought to get rid of them. Things are out of whack here. These are not exactly anti-capitalist. They're sort of at the heart of the system. Is there something fundamentally out of whack here?
Yeah, I would say there are three things that could be improved, because I do agree that CEOs are way overpaid. And the three things that I would say are, one, are the accounting rules. Right now, we don't expense stock options, and we do expense stock and cash pay and other forms of pay. And that has created a huge distortion, which I think is dramatically underestimated. And the reason is because we don't expense stock options, everybody pays in stock options, and virtually all of the pay outrages that we see, the ones that Bob was describing earlier and lots of the other ones we see, have to do with option grants that were not well thought through. People just don't have an easy way of understanding the cost of stock options. And so, for example, the biggest outrage, in my view, was Steve Jobs was once given an option grant that had a Black-Scholes value, which means it had an expected cost of about $500 million. A $500 million.
Well, to the company, to Apple Computer.
Yeah, for Apple Computer. Now, how does that happen? Well, I talked to some of the board members, and their view was, well, he gets 4% of the upside or 5% of the upside, but they don't. If we had to pay in stock, we would never, ever consider giving somebody a pay package that's that large. Options, because, they fall underwater, and because when they're granted, the strike price is equal to the exercise price, people just don't, it's not very transparent how much money is being transferred, because it's an expectation of the future.
So it hasn't been clear how much these enormous pay packages are costing the company, costing the shareholders.
Right. I mean,
turn that around. And you had a couple more you wanted to put on the table.
Yeah. Two is that, fundamentally, boards are too friendly with CEOs. I mean, this is an argument that lots of people make, but, it is correct. When there's a large owner on the board of a company, they think very differently about how they're going to pay the CEO than when it's a bunch of board members who are chosen by the CEO, who are supposed to represent the shareholders, but in fact are, golfing buddies with the CEO. I mean, CEOs even refer to their boards as my board.
Mm-hmm.
How does that happen? It's not their board.
Let me ask you something. You heard at the top of this hour John Cassidy with The New Yorker saying, I posed to him, what if CEO compensation in America was half what it is now? It would still, by the way, be much higher than CEO compensation in Europe and Japan. No real slouches. Would that impact the performance of American corporations? He said no. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think that would have a major impact on corporations. And actually, if you took away all of that money that is going to CEOs, you know, even though I think it's an outrage for lots of reasons having to do with worker morale and the way we view CEOs. In fact, if we took all of that money and distributed it to the poor, it wouldn't make a big difference. I think the reason that we don't want to do it is that there's no good reason to pay people a lot more than what they would get in a good process. And the process that we have has distorted accounting rules, boards that are not adequately representing the shareholders and are therefore giving away too much. And let me make a third point, because this one is more benign and more and seemingly more defensible, but I actually think it's the thing that is really locking in high pay. Companies use surveys in order to pay people. And so here's the way the survey process works. So you're the CEO of Intel, and you're the board, and you want to figure out how much you're going to pay this particular executive. So you hire Towers Perrin or some comp consulting firm, and you say, how much should this executive make? And what they'll tell you is, for a company of this size with an executive of this many years' experience in this particular industry, that should be $9 million total, and 60% of that should be in stock options. And that's a 50th percentile pay package.
Mm-hmm. So that'll be right in the middle of the pack.
50th percentile pay package would be a little bit higher, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And, of course, all boards think that their CEOs are above average, just like 90% of Americans think they're above average
drivers. All the kids in Lake Wobegon. Robert Reich, let me put this to you. Brian Hall says that that it could be much lower and not affect the corporation performance in America. But he says if you took all this money and distributed among the American poor, it wouldn't really make a difference. That kind of suggests that it doesn't matter. But what's your sense of the impact on the American psyche, on American society, of having these vastly different tiers of compensation for a good day's work?
Well, two things, Tom. First of all, we are already living in a society in which the top 1% is doing better than it has ever done. After-tax income of the top 1% has risen about 126% over the 1990s. That's after taxes, after paying taxes, where the median income after taxes has risen about 6%. Now, in that kind of society, it's hard to maintain a democracy, because people don't see each other, they don't talk to each other. Almost every issue becomes a much more fraught with who's going to bear the burden, who is going to pay the cost. But there's something else that has to do with the company itself. Companies that perform very well are companies in which people think of themselves as part of a team. The service is good because workers on the front line are actually providing great services. But those companies will only create a real sense of teamwork if there is not a giant, gaping gap between the pay of people at the top and the people who are average workers. You look at the labor strife in airlines right now. Look at the problems that so many companies are having trying to maintain morale. Not just morale, but even the good graces of their workers. And you see how difficult it is when CEOs are making more and more money and the average workers are losing their jobs or afraid of losing their jobs.
American Airlines asked for $1.8 billion in concessions from their workers while guaranteeing a huge payout to the top 45 executives in the company.
Not even fully disclose to the workers when they agreed on that how much the retirement incomes of those top executives were being protected.
But Robert Reich, what's really going on here? If in Europe CEOs make $400,000, $500,000 a year or less, if they make 20 times the average industrial wage there, why do American CEOs need to, or why do they make 85 times the average wage here? I mean, I know Americans are famously unjealous about good fortune and always hope that they themselves may one day partake in it, and that's a rich and probably a good part of our society. But is there a point at which that gets just out of whack in a way that's destructive, and are we there?
Well, I think we are there, and again, you have only to ask administer the pronoun test. I go around the country very often. I go into a company, an organization. I say, tell me about this place. And I listen for the pronouns that people use. And if they use the pronouns we and our, as in we're trying to do this, or this is our goal, I know it's one kind of an organization, one kind of a company. But if they use the pronouns they and their, as in they are trying to accomplish this, this is their goal, I know it's a very, very different kind of company where the individuals don't feel that their fates are connected to the performance of the company. And, Tom, there is a direct relationship between the extent to which people feel that they are in the same boat and how well that company actually does. If they feel that they are in different boats, one occupied by CEOs and top executives who are in the yachts and everybody else is in the rowboats or the dinghies that are sinking, it's very different. You know, look at a company like, well, even Enron. In the year before Enron really sunk, the CEO Kenny Boy Lay, George W. Bush's
George
friend, earned $152.7 million. Now,
much of that on options that he cashed out as he knew the company was going to the wall.
What is, there's a very thin line between the kind of greed that demands eight-digit kind of compensation package or nine-digit and just skating the law, kind of a contempt, an arrogance for public attitudes, shareholder needs, employee attitudes.
Robert Reich, Brian Hall, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to turn to them. Kevin's calling from Walpole, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
I guess I wanted to talk about comp time that they're coming up with and how it's going to erode my pay and erode my ability to negotiate for time off. It's probably going to increase somebody's stock, but I feel
you're talking about eliminating overtime pay for comp time for overtime. What do you mean exactly, Kevin?
Well, from what I understand, they want to create comp time. There's legislation in Congress, and that what it would do is you could use your overtime pay, use it towards comp time.
Oh, instead of overtime pay, you'll get comp time where you're just not working.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, where you can use it. What the rhetoric that they use is that it's going to that they've heard the American public, and the American public wants to be home with their family, and this is how they're going to do it. But really, you know, it's going to improve their bottom line, and it's going to decrease my pay at the end of the year.
But what's wrong with improving the company's bottom line in your view, Kevin?
Nothing at all. But when they do it, to my detriment, I don't like it, especially when they're making so much money anyway.
Kevin,
I'm just sorry. I work pretty hard. We all do.
Yeah, we hear it and we know it, and we thank you for your call, Brian Hall. Do you hear in American companies this kind of creaking as workers look up and see those huge eight-figure packages that Robert Reich and Kevin describe, look at their own and say this just doesn't add up?
Yeah, I think I basically agree with Bob's earlier point about that this is very demoralizing to workers. I do think it's overstated in the following sense. I actually think workers like Kevin, the guy who just called, care much more about how they're doing rather than how the CEO is doing. One of the reasons why Enron is such a travesty isn't because Kenneth Lay, stole some money from the workers and the shareholders, although that's bad. That's a horrible thing. But the biggest problem with Enron was that they took what could have been a very good company and destroyed so much value that the company no longer exists.
But I wonder if there aren't some fundamental
Don't have jobs, and that's a much bigger issue than the size of executive compensation. In other words, it's the distorted incentives that cause people to do value destroying things that is a much bigger problem than the size of pay. Although I don't want to say the size of pay is not a problem. It's just I think it's secondary to the distorted incentives.
Robert Reich, number one, distorted incentives, and there we see companies like Enron and now many others in the dust.
Well, I don't see how you can completely separate the kind of pay that a CEO or the top executives make from how people like Kevin, who's struggling to make ends meet, looking at the company and saying, gee, they're trying to really increase the bottom line at my expense, how you can separate them entirely. Because, again, if you have a CEO or management team willing to take cuts, willing to share the burden with workers in hard times, those workers are going to say, well, it's necessary. We'll all get through it together. We're all in the same boat. But on the other hand, if you have CEOs who are making out like bandits, and it's known by workers, and again, you have only to look at what happened with American Airlines to see a graphic example of this, then a lot of the workers are going to say, I am not going to sit back and take it. I'm not going to cooperate. I'm going to work to rule. I'm going to drag my feet. I'm not going to give that extra effort, that extra hour, that extra energy that
because
it takes to make this company.
Because we're not all in this
Because we're not in the same boat.
Brian Hall, at a recent conference that you had there at the Harvard Business School, I was struck by some comments from Ed Woolard. I think he's the former or outgoing CEO of DuPont. Is that right?
Yes.
And he said, and here we're talking about a very high-level American CEO himself, and he said, let's look at three myths. He said the number one myth around CEOs is that their compensation is driven up by competition for their unique services. He says, I do not believe that. That, as you pointed out, Brian, that it's very often just about kind of peer grouping and peer, salary setting. He said the second myth is that compensation committees are independent on boards of directors. He says they're not. They're kind of stooges in the pocket of the CEO. And the third myth is that share prices, which have been so key to these huge packages, reflect CEO performance. He says he doesn't believe that either. If all of those are myths, then is it possible that somehow we've ratcheted these salaries up, I don't know, twice what they ought to be, 10 times what they ought to be on average? And do you think that that can over time have some corrosive impact, not on American business, even on the American, as Robert Rice says, democracy at large?
Yes, I agree that the pay has gone up because of the survey process and peers, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And fundamentally, boards are asking the wrong questions. What they ask is, what does the survey say? What they should ask is, how much will it take to attract, retain, and motivate the executive that we're trying to get?
But these numbers aren't really coming down.
If they ask that latter question, I really think they would pay a lot less. There would be no upward ratcheting over time, and we would see a much more competitive market for CEOs. And by the way, getting back to the earlier issue about not being able to separate them, I agree with Bob on that you can't separate them. But we spend all of our time focusing on the level of pay, and we never actually look at some of the details that are hugely important. And let me give you one, for example. One of the reasons why executives are doing, really crazy, distorted things and running up stock prices in ways that are so dangerous and so destroying, value-destroying for society and for the workers, et cetera, is because we have such short vesting schedules on stock options.
So you're saying they so quickly get all that stock in their pockets, just
exactly.
A couple of years
and that
in.
Sounds like a small, boring detail as opposed to the level of pay. But in fact, if you let people run the stock price up, fool the investors, and cash out a bunch of money and leave, unfortunately, some people will succumb to that temptation. And it'd be great if we lived in a world where no one ever, cheated and decided to take the shortcut. But unfortunately, if you put that level of temptation in front of that many CEOs for that long, some small percentage of them are going to destroy a tremendous amount of value.
And yet all the numbers are up very high. Brian Hall, stand by. I want to get just a word from Robert Reich before the break. We're going to come back and talk about it, but can this be turned around?
Yes, I think it can be turned around. Tom, a lot of this, as Brian is suggesting, has to do not only with the way corporations are structured, the way compensation committees are organized, but also laws and rules and tax laws, the ways the whole incentive structure is organized, and that can be changed.
We don't want to kill the golden goose, but we want to give it a good long look. Has Executive America somehow hijacked the process for its own super enrichment? Where are the shareholders here? And how can a market economy correct excesses at the top? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about CEO compensation in America. After scandal and recession and stock market crash, it's still off the charts. My guest tonight, Brian Hall, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School, and Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, now at Brandeis University. You can join the conversation as well. Did you care about executive pay in the boom 90s? Is huge CEO pay necessary for top economic performance? Or does it tear at the social fabric? Has the country been scammed by its CEOs? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joanne's calling. Hi, Joanne. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks. I'm a little nervous, so bear with me. But I was once an employee at the Harvard Business School, and what I saw there from the day that it started was they really stressed competition and leadership, and especially among the different sections of the business school. And I'm sure that Harvard is not the only business school that works this way, but they all stress competition and leadership.
So what's wrong with competition and leadership, Joanne? Those are kind
of... It's fine, except that when these the sections come back later for reunions, you'll see the competition gets to such a level where people are comparing how many sections, how many people within a section has have jets or cars or houses, and it gets very kind of grimy, it appears to me. And then these people are the people who eventually become CEOs, and it's a fairly closed membership.
But these are top dogs in American business. America's a big, rich country. Isn't it inevitable that they'll sort of compare how they do? Money is how we keep score and all that?
Right, but it's the basic training that they get, I don't think, takes into account necessarily what kind of work they do or what quality work is achieved under their tenure, but rather how much better they are than somebody else from another section or from another school. And the way that they compare those two things is not necessarily by how much better they did for their particular company, but how much more they make and how much more they own.
Joanne, we've got it. That's a terrific insight. Thanks for calling. Robert Reich, I wonder about this, and I've seen a little bit of this firsthand, but I have to wonder if we are somehow in this country creating and accepting the notion of a breed apart. A breed that does require those eight-figure salaries, that deserves those eight-figure salaries, a breed somehow not like the rest of Americans, that deserves to live in $20 million, $50 million homes, and it's just fine. Is there kind of artificiality about this?
Well, Tom, certainly there is an artificiality, and it's not something that the Europeans or the Japanese accept. It's not something that in American history we accepted. If you go back not only to the 1950s and 60s, look at CEO pay, but also look at what the CEOs said and did in terms of their feelings, their pronounced, enunciated feelings of corporate responsibility. Now, Joanne talks about Harvard Business School. I don't want to dump on Harvard Business School, but I do hope that after Enron and WorldCom and Global Crossing and executive pay getting so out of touch with reality and the corporate governance scandals, that places like Harvard Business School would ask themselves, what have they been doing to train this generation of business leaders in terms of values, understandings of their position in society? You know, CEOs are custodians of public trust with regard to shareholders and employees, the public in general. Has to trust our CEOs, or we would be, and our entire private sector would be, overwhelmed with regulations. But with that trust comes certain responsibilities.
Brian Hall, what about it? What about at your business school and others? The U.S. Army says it talks about an army of one. Are you somehow breeding, creating a CEO of eight figures, men and women who expect, who believe that they deserve to live in a tier apart from the rest of the country?
No, I agree that problem exists, and that, you know, you're more likely to see that sort of materialism and, you know, discussions about wealth, you know, at business schools than you see at other places.
We want our CEOs to be materially oriented, to create profits, to create wealth, but. Is there somehow a culture that has changed that makes them really see themselves as deserving so much more than other human beings that it can get disassociated even from profits?
No, I actually think that our students want something more than money. You know, like everybody, people want purpose in their lives. They want purpose in their work, and they actually don't. By and large, they don't want only money. And I agree with Bob's earlier point that top executives of companies are holding a public trust. And, you know, we as educators have to do everything we can in order to, you know, help instill in them a sense of accountability. And, in fact, you know, the school is very aggressively moving on that point. We have a ongoing project on corporate governance, leadership, and values.
But does it include compensation?
Yeah.
If you come in and say, we are not going to train you to be CEOs who make $700 million a year, will you lose your students? Will they just go elsewhere?
Well, you know, the lesson isn't about how much you're going to make or how much you're not going to make. I mean, that stuff, you know, is determined, you know, in markets. I think what we... You know, what we can teach people about is integrity, the values that they have when they're leading public companies. We can put in front of them realistic temptations that they will face.
But isn't it possible that they'll still come out of Harvard Business School and say, I know all about ethics now, but I still think that I pretty much deserve $50 million a year?
I don't even know what the word deserve means. I mean, nobody deserves $50 million a year. You know, I think what we...
CEOs make it. Quite a few have made it.
Well, yeah, some people do make that money, but I guess I'm not sure I understand. I mean, what I think we need to do as educators of these leaders is to help them understand the system that they're in, help them understand some of the temptations that are going to come in front of them, and help them understand, how to respond to those temptations and how to take the high road when they do that. I mean, so let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. So one of the sad things that I actually saw in a recent study is they asked a bunch of people from professional schools to talk about what it is the purpose of their profession. So they asked lawyers, mm-hmm. and lawyers said, you know, the purpose of our profession is to uphold the law. They asked doctors, it's to make people healthy. They asked engineers, it was to build bridges. They asked people in business, students in business, what's the purpose of your profession? They didn't have a good answer. They mumbled some things. They had some cynical remarks. Some people talked about making profits. They didn't fundamentally understand the purpose of their profession. That was one of the saddest things that I saw.
And how would you define it, Brian Hall?
I would say the purpose of business is to create value for society. And that sounds a little bit like I'm a socialist or something, but that's not at all true, because
no.
I think profitable companies that make money for their shareholders are building great things for people. They help workers make more money over time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can go on and on and on.
Absolutely.
But I actually think it is a noble thing, and we need to help people understand that noble thing and understand what a great travesty something like Enron is,
and
or American Airlines.
And I think Americans understand in their bones the value that can come out of this market system. They see it. They live in it. It's made this country enormously wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm giving Brian Hall a hard time here, Robert Reich. But I have to say, I have seen what looks to me like a kind of fraternity with a little bit of sorority, just a little bit of it in there, of expectations that CEOs belong to a kind of aristocracy that should exist on a different level, that needn't operate on the same basis as the rest of society. And I don't see yet, 2 years after the end of the boom, I don't really see, despite the talk about this coming down, the numbers are still so high, I don't see this being brought back down to earth, even when the covers have been lifted and the value that Brian Hall talks about very often was not there.
Tom, I don't see it really changing in any dramatic way. As John Cassidy said at the start of the show, there was a lot of talk about corporate governance before the Iraqi war. Very little has been done. There's a lot of talk in business schools about corporate ethics since Enron, and maybe those ethics courses have been expanded a little bit, patched up here and there. But the fundamental rethinking about not only what we teach young people who are going into and want to become CEOs and corporate executives, but also what are the set of incentives, how laws and regulations ought to be set up so that we avoid these excesses, has not been done. And I can tell you, as former Secretary of Labor, I talk to a lot of workers, I continue to talk to a lot of average workers who are deeply cynical about how American industry is organized. You said initially, Tom, that everybody wants to be a millionaire. Sure they do. People do not resent people who are rich, but there is a deep and abiding resentment having to do with the fact that so many people's jobs are on the line, so many people are basically having a very hard time making ends meet in this recession. The stock market has collapsed. People's savings have gone, disappeared essentially, and yet there doesn't seem to be any accountability.
A sense of proportion. Tom's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi there. I've got a lot of quick points that I want to make with you.
Okay.
Number one, I want everybody to remember that there was a former corporate executive named Townsend who wrote a book back in the early 60s called Up the Organization.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the major points that this man made in his book was that for every executive at that, remember, this is in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. For every executive you show me making $100,000 a year, I'll find you 15 guys that will do that job for half that amount of money. And another thing he predicted in his book is that what you see happening right now would happen in the future. And this was 30 years ago this guy predicted.
So you're saying this is inevitable somehow, Tom? Why?
No, not inevitable. What he's saying, remember that this man was a corporate executive himself, all right? He was watching this develop.
But why do we have this in the United States and not in Europe, not in Japan? And for a while, our economy has done much better, but right now I'm not so sure. Why here?
Why it has happened is because there has been an escape from regulation. Our society has the Republican administration and the executives and whatnot.
But Tom, that's supposed to be a good thing. That's supposed to unleash value.
They have very pragmatically disassembled the regulatory agencies in this United States. All right. Another point I want to make is that. Am I allowed to mention the names of corporations and whatnot here?
Sure, go for it.
Okay, I worked for Emerson Electric Corporation back in the early 80s, and I remember at that time watching what was going on in that corporation. The CEO had five guys that sat on the committee that determined his bonus, all right? Three of them worked for him in the company, all right? The other two were CEOs from other corporations, and he sat on the board in their corporations, and he also sat on their bonus committee.
That's about what Brian Hall and Robert Reich are describing tonight, Tom. Thanks for your call. Brian Hall, I want to ask you, Business Week is talking this week about a backlash against obscene pay, saying that the golden era in executive compensation is over. Do you think that's true? Does that mean it will actually come down, or will it just stay where it's been?
I think because boards continue to use surveys, I don't see how with the surveys it's going to come down very dramatically, quite honestly. And secondly, I actually think the thing that would make the biggest difference is if we began to expense stock options, because once we do that, then we're going to see a big move towards restricted stock.
Make them not so cheap to ladle out. And Robert Reich, what's your view? Where are we headed here? Will this be reined in? Will it become a permanent part of the American landscape that a certain tier lives in the hyper-wealthy world and the rest do not?
Well, Tom, let's put it this way. We are moving very, very rapidly to a society that is divided between an aristocracy of the wealthy and then a middle class and then a poor a group of people who really are becoming more and more concentrated geographically. We cannot, as a society, maintain social cohesion, whether we have a war or don't have a war, when we have that kind of a split in our society. And now, there are a lot of things that can be done. Brian has talked about expensing in stock options. We can have a vesting rule. We can have truly independent directors on compensation committees. We can do something the Clinton administration initially tried to do, and that was say to companies, look, if an executive gets more than $1 million, you can't deduct anything more than $1 million from your corporate income taxes as pay. There are a lot of possibilities here, but ultimately it comes down to a sense of responsibility. You asked before why executives in this country, why we let them get away with it, why they get away with it, why they think it's completely appropriate. Well, I want to come back to the word shame. I want to come back to the word responsibility. People, in some sense, are shameless. Conservatives talk a lot about lacking shame in this country, but I think that it's unseemly when we're laying people off, when so many people are in trouble, for executives to have that kind of a compensation.
Well, we'll see what ensues. Robert Reich, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And Brian Hall, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Robert Reich is former Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, professor of social and economic policy at Brandeis. And Brian Hall is professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. You can continue this conversation online. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.